Okay, so this first map is a map of how Shem, Ham, and Japheth, at least what we believe to be the way that they populated the earth after the flood. Does it matter exactly? No, but it is interesting. Some of the names on here, like this Arphaxad, is actually one of the ancestors of Abraham, which then helps us to understand why when he first comes on the scene, he is this part of the world. That's Ur of the Chaldees. So this is just a map, okay? Comments about this map? Questions about this map? So here's a progression, if you will. Notice we picked up the learning about Abram, in Genesis, the 12th chapter. And in Genesis 12, the first time we really hear about him, there's some connection to Ur, a city this part of the world. You'll see the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in this map. Those are two of the rivers that are mentioned in the description about the boundaries of the Garden of Eden. And so with those two pieces of information, good luck. You try to find the garden. But two of the four are actually mentioned in the book of Genesis. But this is generally believed to be the cradle of civilization, if you will. I think to be more accurate, the cradle of civilization is probably up in the area of Turkey, where Noah first landed after the ark rested. But this thing right here, and you notice the green shading? That's called the Fertile Crescent, and it's just because of that. It's because it's more fertile. Do you think about that time of the part of the world as being fertile? I think of it as being desert. But for some reason, scholars just commonly refer to the Fertile Crescent. Abram is mentioned as being called out from Ur of Chaldea, or the Chaldees. He is in Haran, or Haran, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, when God first speaks to him in Genesis 12. And then just in the next couple of chapters, or we're going to look at chapter 15, he travels down into this area, which is Canaan. There's a famine. That famine takes him over into Egypt for a short term. He comes back into Canaan. God speaks to him at times. There are certain events that are happening throughout the book of Genesis. But what's interesting to me is that when God talks to him about the promise of a land, this land isn't his yet. It isn't his yet, but he's in the land, and God says, I'm going to give you this, but not yet. So we go to the next map. Any questions or comments about that map? Oh, by the way, lots of red lines. Those are believed to be the trade routes. There were lots of things happening in the world apart from God's people. They weren't the only people populating the earth at that time. And so mankind had begun to develop routes, if you will, highways, they called them. And that's what those red lines are meant to show. Main roads are called here. Okay, now we focus down a little bit later in the Bible, and we're going to talk about the land promise a little bit more in just a minute. But eventually, God's people show up into a group of 70. Joseph, his brothers, and that group show up in Egypt, particularly Goshen. And we're going to talk about what happens in Egypt, the plagues and that sort of thing. And eventually they leave. And they leave and they travel west or east, southeast. And this is the Sinai Peninsula. And so here is another man's depiction of what it might have looked at, where they traveled to, where they stopped. Again, these might help us, and they might not. This is where Sinai has generally been believed to be. Do you notice where it's at on this map? It's over here, and has begun the last 10, 15 years to be more of a prevailing attitude now, is that Sinai wasn't here. It's over here. Does it matter? No, it doesn't matter, but I find that interesting. And what we do know is the children of Israel did not go from A to B in a straight line. We know that. Yes. Okay, so first of all, Britt says it does matter. Of course it matters from a biblical standpoint. Being able to pinpoint where it is may not matter. Now, look at the detail on this map. This is called the Red Sea. This is called the Red Sea. Generally speaking, scholars say that the children of Israel did not cross down here or here. Well, this author does. But the crossing of the Red Sea refers to up here in the delta of the Nile. That there, I mean, if you've done any looking at this part of the world, you'll notice that here's the Nile, and it's a single, you know, it's a single line of water. But when you get close to the Mediterranean Sea, it fans out into just a huge delta. I guess kind of like what we have down in Louisiana, or over in Louisiana. But so, to Britt's comment, whether they cross the Red Sea here, whether they cross the Red Sea here, whether it's up here, they cross the Red Sea. That's a certainty. And did they show up at Sinai? That's a certainty as well. I just don't want us to get too hung up about this map has to be exact. It's man's. It's authored by a man. And that by itself makes it potentially a problem. Now here's another picture. This does show more the traditional Mount Sinai location, crossing the Red Sea up here, then coming down. And some of these places have even been identified. We could look at those. We probably won't have time. Then the children of Israel eventually come up north, whether they spend time here or here. But eventually they're up here approaching the land of Canaan. And that's when the problems occur. And God says, you're not going into the land of Canaan right now. And so they wander. We don't have much detail about where they are exactly during the wandering. We have some detail. And then eventually they come up and they cross over into Canaan from the east going west. They travel along the east side of the Dead Sea. We believe that's the case because there was some interaction with two groups of people on this side over here on their way to Canaan. Do you remember what groups of people that was? Pardon me? Ammonites, Ammon, and Moab, and Edom. All three are over in that part of the world, okay? And then here's another picture. Maybe it's a little bit clearer to see. Okay. The bottom line is maps are there to help us, and they may help us. They may also be confusing. Okay, that's my point. Any other comments or questions about any of this? Britt, any follow-up on that? Okay, Genesis 15. I want to look at Genesis 15 because it kind of captures a lot of what we are going to finish in our study now today. We already mentioned Genesis 12 is where Abram was first approached by the Lord, and there were promises made, the three great promises, okay? We have that information. We have just a few chapters later, by the way, in between, there's been a war with the kings where Abram has stepped in and rescued Lot. He's been blessed by Melchizedek. So there's some great events that have happened. But picking up in chapter 15, Abram approaches the Lord in verse 2 and says, you promised me children. You promised me the seed promise, and I don't have a child. And so the Lord begins to help him to understand. Picking up in verse 2 of Genesis 15, Abram says, O Lord God, what will you give me since I'm childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. Verse 3. Verse 4. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he takes him outside in verse 5, and he starts to show him some things. And it says in verse 5 and 6 that Abram believed God. And yet he doesn't see the culmination of the promises just yet. Dropping down to page to verse 12. Abram's still, you know, he's wanting some validation, even though he's credited here with being a believer. It's fair to have the need to have some validation. And picking up in verse 13, actually, God says to Abram, And he's speaking, it appears from verse 12, he's in a deep sleep. Now listen to what he tells Abram beginning in verse 13. God says to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge that nation whom they will serve, and afterwards they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." Summarize what God told Abram. What did he tell him?
"You will not see the promise."
Okay, you're not going to see it, so stop asking. Okay, good. What else? I'm sorry? Well, you're going to go to your fathers in peace. Notice back in verse 14, verse 13 and 14, this group of people that I've promised you, your seed, it's going somewhere else. And they're going to be in a nation, they're going to be under the control of a nation. And what is that nation going to do? They're going to oppress them. Oh, but after some time, and this is God's time, God's calendar, after some time, God's going to say, or God says, they will come out with many possessions. How did the children of Israel, who were slaves in Egypt, being made to go gather their own straw even at times and build, you know, build mortar and use the mortar and straw to build clay, how would they leave Exodus, pardon me, how would they leave Egypt having anything at all? Do you remember? The Bible says they plundered Egypt. By the time God was done with Egypt, with the plagues, they were begging Israel to leave. "Here, you want this? Please take it. Here, you want this? Please take it." It's the same approach, or similar approach, when the children of Israel takes the land of Canaan. They walk in, they subdue it over a few years. There are vineyards already planted. There are houses already built. And they walk in and they essentially homestead, to use a common phrase. They simply step in and take possession of the land, and it's already fully functioning at the time. But God gives Abram just a little bit of an insight here. And he didn't tell him about Egypt in chapter 12, and he didn't mention Egypt by name here. But he did specify, this is the land I'm going to give you. And it's the land, by the way, verse 19, 20, and 21, it's the land where the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Cabanite and the Hittite and the Perizzite, oh, wow, those big names. Those are the people that lived there right then. And God says that their iniquity is not yet ready for you to come in and take this from them, but you will. That is your seed. That's chapter 15. So God gives Abram just a little more information. The discussion begins again. It picks up in chapter 17, where, again, Abram is struggling somewhat. Yes, Abram is a believer in God, but like many of us, we try to put things our own way. We try to do things our own way, and he starts working down some paths to do things his own way, and God has to kind of correct him. We have the issue of circumcision being set up beginning in chapter 17. The point is, God is unfolding this plan in pieces. And Abram learned a little bit more about that. Now to page 10 in your lesson book. We, last week, looked at the great nation. Before God is going to give this land, Canaan, to the seed of, or to the descendants of Abram, they first have to grow in size and I guess it'd be sort of foolish, wouldn't it, to say this is your land and you're only 70 strong. You wouldn't be capable of even really populating it. I understand God is in control and he can do whatever he wants to, but God's plan was to first grow in size, become millions in size, and you'll do that while you're in Egypt, and then I'm going to bring you back into this land, and that's what he's doing. On page 10, we mentioned last week about the great nation. And there are some, the material, bottom of page 10, refers to the church as being an antitype or a similarity, if you will. And actually, Peter uses the term nation when he's referring to you and me and our spiritual relationship to God. So sometimes it's referred to as a priesthood. Same verse. Sometimes it's referred to as a family. Sometimes it's referred to as a nation. So it's one of the many ways that God describes his people, even in the New Testament. That's the great nation. And we see that really coming to fruition between Genesis and Exodus, because Genesis leaves 70 strong. Exodus begins millions strong. And they had grown in size to the point that the Egyptians now feared them. They tried to intervene and tried to prevent the Israelites from even growing further, growing stronger, which didn't, that doesn't stop God's plans. And so ultimately God has to deliver some very powerful experiences to Egypt through the plague. Okay, so that's the great nation. Page 11. So the land promise is primarily in the book of Joshua. If you have spent some time in the book of Joshua studying, you'll realize that the three primary campaigns of how the children of Israel went into Canaan, again, they travel around the east side, we believe, the east side of the Dead Sea, and then came in. And what was the first place that they conquered? Jericho. What was the second place they tried to conquer? Ai. So the story of Ai is what? What did the children of Israel learn from Ai? Yes, and if I may paraphrase what Kyle said, full obedience is what God expects. Or if I put it sort of in the framework of the lesson, there were some conditions to God's promises. And even though he allowed them to take Jericho, when they took it, at least one individual did some things they should not have. He should not have. And as a result, God had to send a strong message, not this time to a Canaanite city, but to the children of Israel specifically. And so we see conditions woven throughout the development and the fulfillment of these promises. But at the end of the book of Joshua, there are two passages here. Someone turn to Joshua 21, please. We're going to read verses 43 and 45 through 45. And then someone else, if you would turn to Joshua 23. We're going to read verses 14 and 16. Need a volunteer. David, are you there? Thanks for volunteering, sir. Okay, all right, hold that for a second. Joshua 21.
I'll take it.
Okay.
Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it, and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises
Wow, that's pretty definitive, isn't it? That's pretty clear. Okay, so you're going to accept the word of God and accept the book of Joshua. You're going to accept that passage along with it. Now, David, if you'd read the chapter 23, verses 14 through 16.
So the Lord will bring upon you all the evil things that Eli has destroyed you from off
Okay. David's reading brings something else into what we didn't see maybe as clearly in the first reading, is that the conditions, therefore, are reminded again. Okay? So the first passage is very clear that it was given. God completed exactly as he promised. And now this one is a reminder that, okay, now remember some of the lessons we've even learned the hard way, that God's blessings are conditional. And you see that throughout the Old Testament as well as the New Testament, okay? So even though we're not even talking about the New Testament yet, not directly, we start to see how God works. We start to get a sense of how he interacts with man. And when he says something, he means it. And he holds man accountable for what man does, okay? There's also a comment here from Hebrews 4. Let's turn that, look there real quickly. Hebrews 4, verses 8 through 11, about a reference in the New Testament about how heaven is similar, okay? The writer here says an antitype, okay? There's some similarity. So let's look at Hebrews 8, please. Pardon me. Hebrews 4, 8 through 11. I need another volunteer, please. Now think about this for a minute. Suppose you had never studied the Old Testament. It was an unknown to you. And you're reading the passage that Jim just read from Hebrews. Would it make much sense to you? I'm getting a lot of blank stares. Maybe it's a vague question. You wouldn't even know what the rest he's referring to. You might guess, you might have some insight. But again, if you've never studied it or never seen the Old Testament, then the New Testament, I'm not going to say it's empty, but it doesn't have the force, or it doesn't have the clarity, if you will. Because the Old Testament, as 1 Corinthians 10 tells us, is there to teach us, to give us these examples that we might better serve our God and better know how he acts and interacts with man. The third promise, the messianic promise you see on page 11, we're going to spend a lot of time on that when we come to the New Testament, which is the fulfillment of that. But God is working towards that promise throughout the Old Testament. Notice at the bottom of page 11, all three promises are fulfilled. You can't do this. You can't say, I'm just not sure that the three promises, God delivered on the three promises, but I still trust the Bible. Those are not compatible. The Bible clearly talks about all three of those as being fulfilled, delivered, with their conditions, in a manner, in a way that God delivered it. But nevertheless, it did happen. Questions or comments? Yes, John.
Therefore, that
I like the way that you summed that up. There are good people out there that misunderstand those verses that we just looked at and draw incomplete or incorrect conclusions about those passages. And then they couple that up with misunderstanding some of the things that Jesus has taught and showed in the New Testament. And now you have peoples who are expecting the nation of Israel to step back in and recover. And by the way, if you think that's a foreign concept that doesn't impact you, it does impact you, because that probably is playing into some political decisions even today. Okay? Not intending to get us off on a political rally of anything like that. But some have argued, and I believe they're correctly saying so, some have argued that there's a strong desire to keep Israel whole today because of the very thing that Sean referred to. You know, Jesus is going to come back, right? He's going to come back and he's going to set up an earthly kingdom in Israel. And wouldn't it be nice for us to ally with Israel? There's nothing the New Testament tells us we should do that. Kelly? I can now.
Okay, another part of what Sean is talking about is also tied up in God's promises being fulfilled, because a part of the eschatology and premillennials is that God's plan for the church and the kingdom actually failed.
Absolutely.
And the church was a substitute, a stopgap to the kingdom God intended to set up. It wasn't a stopgap or anything, because God's promises don't fail.
Another excellent point. Did you hear that in the back? That many people have concluded that the church, what you and I are part of, what we take so much confidence and comfort in, is just, it was sort of a mistake on God's part. And he kind of just threw it in there at the last minute to, that's a stopgap. Yes, Eric. And that is validated over and over throughout the Bible, because God delivers, even though he doesn't deliver in our time frame, right? That and we see the ultimate victory of everything that Jesus set out to do. So we scratch our heads when good people, and I emphasize good people, because these are not lunatics, but they have reached incorrect conclusions. And God loves them, and we should do what we can to help them to understand the correct full story. Page 13, the Exodus. Okay, so on page 12, which we looked at last week, we have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and all those detailed events and detailed updates about their lives. Not everything was great, but ultimately we find Joseph bringing his brothers into Egypt, because Joseph, Joseph has risen from being in prison to the number two man in the kingdom of Egypt. That's got to be more than a coincidence, don't you think? That's another conversation for another time, but that's what we have. So when the book of Exodus begins, where is Joseph? Where is Joseph? Pardon me? When the book of Exodus begins, where's Joseph? He's dead. He's dead, and so are his sons and his sons and his sons and his sons. Okay, some time has transpired. In fact, as we've already looked at in the study, 400 years, give or take. So it's more than just a generation or two. It's some generations. And what you have now is a whole different view of the children of Israel by the Egyptian powers, Pharaoh. Okay? So, look at page 13. We are very familiar about the plagues. You remember the life of Moses? He is raised because his mom puts him in a basket, and he is protected. And eventually, the daughter of Pharaoh raises him, and so he comes up to being a young man. And he's very much in a position of some authority and power. But then this problem occurs where he sees one of his Jewish countrymen being abused by an Egyptian, and he intervenes, and he has to leave town because of that. So he goes to Midian. Midian is over here on this map. Well, at least we believe it to be over here. So he goes to Midian for 40 years, and then God speaks to him. Remember the burning bush, and how God says, I have a plan for you. And what's Moses' response? What is Moses' response when God says, I have a plan for you, Moses? Yeah, who me? Yeah, and he begins to make excuses. Again, I want to emphasize this because these are... I started to call Moses an everyday person. He's an extraordinary person. But he has some of the faults and challenges that you and I have. So he proceeds to make excuses, and God answers those excuses. He gives him the ability to perform miracles. He brings Aaron, his brother, in as a spokesperson, and so on. Moses now is going to enter into Pharaoh and say what? Yeah. Now you think about that. You're going to walk into the most important person in that part of the world, and you're going to say, oh, by the way, you know these millions of people out here that are slave labor for you, and they're doing all these, they're delivering this great amount of work for you. Let them go. Pharaoh's response? No. And so we see what I find interesting, and this is something I was reminded of as I was studying for this lesson, reminded of the interaction between Pharaoh and Moses and the Lord throughout these plagues. Because Pharaoh would say what? There was a plague, and then what would be his position? At times, what would be his position? Let him go. Okay, that's, yeah. And then the moment that the plague was dismissed, what would happen? I changed my mind. In fact, the Lord even says, I know he's going to change his mind. Let's look at a couple passages. Let's look at Exodus 4 and verse 5, please. This is where God is interacting with Moses and saying, and he's showing him how when you do this, this will happen. Verse 4, but the purpose, verse 5, is what? That they may believe. Okay, so God doesn't expect Moses to walk in there and just, you know, not have any validation at all of what is happening, okay? It begins there where God says, this whatever's going to happen over the next several chapters, the intent is that they believe you are my messenger. Now, chapter 9 and verse 16, please. Someone read that. Wow, okay, so this is into the plagues now, and I think it's actually the boils, isn't it? And God is saying, you know what, I'm clearly in control of this, back sort of to Eric's comment. He's always in control, and ultimately he does deliver, but he's in control of these plagues, and notice his purpose. I've allowed you to remain. I have allowed you, Pharaoh, to remain. Why? Why? Why are you still here, Pharaoh? Eric, 5 minutes? Okay. Because I want you to truly believe who I am and what I can do. Have you ever thought why God felt the need to go through all the plagues? Couldn't he have just been as spontaneous, if you will, and just say, children of Israel, leave, and you're going out tomorrow? And with God's help, God's assistance, they would have left, right? But there's this series of plagues that God puts into play because, first of all, he wants Israel to know, and he wants the Egyptians to know that he is God. And if we jumped forward a few books, there's an individual by the name of Rahab who clearly understood and heard what had happened in Egypt. She didn't live in Egypt. So God very much wants the world to know I'm in control. Some have speculated that these plagues are specific to the gods of Egypt. Okay, maybe they are, maybe they're not. That's an interesting study, an interesting, you can go down that sideline. But there is an alignment between some of them and some of the Egyptians. Yes, sir, Kyle. Which brings more power to it, doesn't it? I mean, now they weren't just referring to, Rahab wasn't referring to what happened last week. It was 40 years prior. Okay, very good point. Very good point. Okay, on page 13, we have the 10 plagues. Most of us have studied the plagues. What I found interesting was that there were times when Egyptians listened to God's warning. For instance, I think it was the hail. When hail was being pronounced upon the land, the Egyptians, some of the Egyptians, it calls them who believed, they went and they pulled their livestock inside. Okay? There were times when the plague impacted the children of Israel as well. Not every time. So, again, we could spend a lot of time trying to dissect exactly why this happened, why that happened. I don't know. What I do know is that God had a plan that he started back in the earliest chapters of the book of Exodus, and we see it following all the way through chapter 12 when Pharaoh finally says, I've had enough. And they were so distraught over the last plague and the impact that it had on everyone who didn't believe, is they just wanted the children of Israel to leave. Please just go and take whatever you want with you. Questions or comments? There's a reference, bottom of page 13, to the Passover, which is mentioned in the New Testament, and we have the alignment, the similarities of that and New Testament things, if you will. I mean, it doesn't take much to figure out how this compares to this. Yes, Reagan.
Oh,
go ahead.
I would say before, because I know next class we're going to start on the Ten Commandments. There's something that I think that's impressive about as we outline this in God's character is before He gives those Ten Commandments, before He gives the law, before He says this is whatever I expect of you, He shows His children, you can trust me. I'm going to take care of you. And I think we see that as this beautiful expression of I'm going to rescue you, I'm going to save you, I'm going to show you my power, I'm going to do all that. So then when I give you the law, you can trust me. I'm not giving this to you. I'm not untried. I'm not, this is something that you can look at and see that I am good, that you can trust me. And so here's the law and follow me. We see that in this part of the story.
Excellent point. Consider at the close of the book of Deuteronomy, the first five books, right? At the end of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is somewhere around here. He's been informed by God, you're not going into the promised land. And so he's capturing everything from creation in Genesis 1 up to the wanderings. We have the laws in the book of Leviticus. The numbering, the numbers, that sort of thing, in the book of Numbers. Ha ha, surprise, surprise. And it does exactly what Reagan just said. It gives us the confidence because God is tried. He's been tried and tested several times, and guess what? He delivers. But a reminder, he had not completed every promise yet. And that's where we get hung up sometimes, because we're expecting God to complete his promises on our time frame. Okay. Thank you for your comments. Not lesson four next time. Do we know? We're doing something different next week. Sean will have the class next week.